All right. So it's 8:15. I think we might still have some people trickling in, but we may as well make a start. First of all, thank you, everyone, for coming to my session, first of the day. I know there's a lot of good sessions on, and it's hard to pick which ones you want to go to, so I do appreciate you all, you know, choosing to be here. I thought I'd just start really quickly. Can I just get, from my own interest, how many people were at the last Ignite we did in 2015? Okay, and keep your hand up if you went to my security presentation in 2015. Okay, awesome. So I must have done something right. And then who's here for the first time at Ignite? Awesome. Okay, excellent. One final question. Who's new to the Office 365 security and compliance sort of story? Who's never heard of it or seen a presentation or... Okay, so, all right, excellent. So what I did with this presentation was I kind of looked at it as an update on what I did last time and what's changed in the last year or so. So trying to highlight the sort of key security and compliance features. Obviously, this presentation is recorded, well, at least so I'm led to believe. The deck will be available from Channel 9. I believe my previous session will be linked as a related session on Channel 9. So if you want to go back and get some additional context, that's still valid as well. And that has some additional resources in there. Yeah, I think because it's recorded, I'm going to just talk at you for the next hour. Hopefully, I've got some time for questions at the end. But I'm going to be around in the speaker, oh, sorry, the showcase area, or I've got another session tomorrow. So if you've got questions, do come find me. So I thought I'd start with a quick recap for some people, or maybe just a touch on the key points if it's new to you. In terms of we're hearing from customers that there are concerns with security. It's preventing adoption of SaaS offerings. Compliance is obviously a huge thing for everybody. You know, compliance requirements, even just being able to protect your own data, make sure your business can continue to operate. And transparency. You know, how do you grow your cloud usage while having, you know, trust in the platform and being confident in its usage? So, you know, we need your data in order to run the service. The service doesn't work without you putting data into it, and you don't get value out of it without the data into it. But we know that in order for you to put data in, you have to trust what we're doing, and that trust has to be earned. So our commitment to trust is really centered around these four key areas, and that focuses both on the built-in capabilities, so the things that we do for all customers just inherently as part of the service, and then also customer controls where you can actually tailor it, because we don't build for a specific industry or vertical or that sort of thing. You know, you guys are the ones who are going to know what's best for your particular business. So obviously we'll talk about security, we talk about privacy, we talk about compliance, and we talk about transparency and operations. So what we've done so that you know it's not a black box, you know, how does Office 365 work and that sort of thing. From a security perspective, again, you know, things we're hearing from customers, 160 million customer records compromised. I just saw a figure the other day too, they're saying it's now average about $4 million cost of a security breach. So, you know, you can see that these are pretty serious implications if we are having data compromised through this environment or through environments in general. 229 days between infiltration and detection. The days of somebody attacking your system and you knowing about it straight away are over. You know, we have people sitting inside networks for months at a time before we actually find out that they're there. And that's why we operate under an assumed compromise mentality. So we're operating our entire service under the idea that at any one time we've been compromised already, and we need to account for that. So we'll talk about how that plays through in some of the decisions we've made. Senior managers using personal accounts for work, or really just in general, people using shadow IT. You know, we know that if you don't give users a sanctioned way of doing things, they're going to go and find some other way to do their job. It's not malicious. They just need to be able to share files, or they need to be able to collaborate with people. So what implications does that have? This growth in electronic data is huge too. How do you manage that? And of course, the ever-evolving industry standards. So Microsoft is uniquely positioned to address these security capabilities because we have this, you know, we have the platform, we have the intelligence, and we have the partners. That's our unique approach. We actually spend over $1 billion a year just on security research and development. So we're one of the biggest security companies in the world that people perhaps don't know about. So the key advantages we have, if we look at platform, we own the whole experience. We have the user identity, we have the applications and the data, we have the devices that people are connecting from, and we have the infrastructure in order to support all of that. So what that looks like is our security platform. You can see here all of the different components that come into view. This is an Office 365 session. Obviously, I'm going to be focused on the right-hand side, but we depend on a lot of these services, so I will make reference to some of these things. And also, we have a lot of good sessions at Ignite this year on some of these topics. So I believe there's a Windows Server session right after this in this room. Over in 5 and 6, I believe, there's a session on enterprise mobility and security. So it'll cover some of the Intune or Azure Active Directory and those sorts of capabilities. And then there's an Azure Information Protection session. I think it's on Thursday or Friday. So lots of good sessions you can go to, lots of information on these different capabilities. So because of all of that, because of that platform, we have access to a lot of information about how people are using the system. So you can see we're getting signals from a lot of different areas, how people are logging on, the devices people are using, the traffic flows, the email traffic that's going through, with phishing campaigns or malware campaigns or those sorts of things. This isn't customer data. This is aggregate signal information that's coming through that we can use to build a picture of what's going on in that environment. So this is what we refer to as the Microsoft Intelligent Security Graph. All of these signals are feeding in, and we can develop a picture from there that help us do things like detect when a login might be suspicious or certain traffic might be suspicious or it's the start of a targeted campaign. So when you think about what that means, we're getting 300 billion user authentications each month we're processing. You know, 1 billion Windows devices updated, 200 billion emails analyzed. So again, we're uniquely positioned to be able to take all of that intelligence and feed that back into the product to enhance it for you. So you'll see that bubbling through in really all of the presentations. And finally, our partnership approach as well. So we have connections with our peers in other organizations. We're working with industry alliances, and we work very closely with governments too through the transparency centers that we've set up. So when we talk about reinventing productivity, productivity is no longer what are the features in Word or features in Excel or you know those sorts of things that we traditionally associate with productivity. Can we do co-authoring in a web browser? We're really looking now at this digital transformation. So this idea that we're focused on collaboration, we're focused on mobility, we have to have intelligence permeating through the platform, and everything has to be underlied by this foundation of trust. You're probably aware that we have this global cloud, this global network of data centers. We have over 100 data centers worldwide. We have two in Australia that we operate Office 365 and Azure from. So if you go and sign up for Office 365 today and you said Australia is the country, you will land in Australia. We contractually commit to keeping your data in Australia as well. So we operate on a regional strategy. So you know, North America, Canada is now a region, Asia Pacific, Europe, and then some further division inside Europe and Australia. So we might, hypothetically, if we brought on additional data centers in Australia, say we added, Perth and Adelaide, your data would actually spread across all four data centers in that region, but we would never go outside of Australia. So we're always making that contractual commitment to stay within the Australian residency. We don't run active backup or active passive. It's all active across all of the data centers. So, the standards, the next slide. Some of the standards that are applied to the data centers, we have a very robust control framework that allows us to map to the regulatory requirements that might be in all the different markets. We operate the service exactly the same in every country. So even though IRAP is listed down here as being relevant to the Australian market, the Australian Office 365 instance is exactly the same as everywhere else. So effectively, they meet the IRAP requirements as well. It's just something for you to think about. These are more about which standards apply in which regions as opposed to, where do they actually, or are relevant as opposed to where do they apply. So just to wrap up on some privacy concerns, the key point here is that you're the owner of the data. We're just processing it for you. We're just hosting it. You're the actual owner of the data. You're the one who's in control of it. We don't use your data for anything other than what you provided it to us for, which is to run the service. So we need to be able to scan it for email, malware or viruses, or those sorts of things. But we're not looking at that data for customer, we're not mining it for advertising or anything from that. We give you privacy controls to configure who has access to your data. We're strong advocates for data privacy. You can see that through the work we've done with the US government, with the through our chief counsel, those sorts of things. And I talked about the strong contractual commitments. Transparency, obviously very important to us. You always know where your data is stored. We have a capability inside the Office 365 portal now in the administration center where you can actually go and see where your data is hosted. So it's probably relevant if you were a previous office or an existing Office 365 customer and you wanted to move into the Australian data center, you can actually see where the services are hosted. Have you moved in it? who has access to your data, under what circumstances. We're very clear about this. We have a lot of information in the Trust Center, which I'll share with you later. You have auditing, so you can see all of this, you know, all the information on the uptime and the system events, and obviously the service performance through the dashboard and the reporting as well. Security kind of breaks down into the three areas. We talk about operational security, and these are, again, I'm not going to go into detail on this. There are previous documents or presentations that cover it, but the sort of things you would expect from physical security, security of the environment, encryption across the environment. I think some of the interesting things here are the zero standing permissions to data. So nobody at Microsoft has access to data inside Office 365. It's all automated. If we do have to go to access customer data for some reason, which is probably because you opened a support request and you had some sort of incident, then they have to go through a just-in-time escalation. They can only get access for very specific purposes, for very specific PowerShell commands, all those sorts of things. So we'll talk a little bit more about that one. The other one there being the red team. So, you know, this idea that you would do annual penetration testing, well, we have a red team at Microsoft whose whole job is just to attack Office 365. And there are obviously conditions on that so that they're not doing denial of service attacks or compromising customer data. But their sole purpose is just to attack our network, attack our operators, attack whatever they can, find weaknesses in the environment. If they see a vulnerability or some sort of exploit in the industry, a company got hit with this hack, let's go and try and replay it in Office 365 and see if we're vulnerable. So we're constantly operating under that idea that we're already compromised and we don't know about it. And obviously the blue team for the response to that as well. Bug bounty programs worth mentioning too. We often get asked, how can I do my own penetration testing or vulnerability assessments of Office 365? You can do that through the bug bounty program. So again, there's some terms and conditions, but you are free to do that now. Safeguarding your data. Sorry. So you can see we have capabilities across a lot of different product areas. So in terms of encryption, using Azure Information Protection, so you can go beyond the encryption and permanently associate that with the data. Data loss prevention to sort of safeguard what's going outside the organization. Some visibility through Secure Score, being able to control your environment and improve on your environment. So we'll talk about Secure Score later. Some of the other capabilities, the mobile device management, mobile application management, that'll be covered in the enterprise mobility session. Protecting against external threats. Exchange Online Protection is there as part of every Office 365 subscription that uses Exchange Online. So you have contractual commitments to 100% known malware detection, 99% spam effectiveness. That's on for every Exchange Online customer. If you want to go beyond that, we have Advanced Threat Protection, which is a zero-day protection, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit more later in the session. Threat Intelligence is a new capability we announced. It'll be out in the next couple of months, so we'll talk about that, and I'm going to do some additional information on that tomorrow in my session. Advanced Security Management, we'll talk about. Conditional Access and Multi-Factor Authentication, don't really have much in this deck on that, but again, the EMS guys will talk to that. You know, those capabilities are there, so you can do that with the platform as well. And on compliance, we've talked about some of these things already, and we'll go into more detail. Customer Lockbox is very helpful to our highly regulated customers because it gives you that ability to say, I have final say over who gets access to my data. You have full audit tracking across the environment no matter what, so you can turn that on. We have Advanced eDiscovery, which I'll talk about, and Service Assurance and Advanced Data Governance we'll be talking about as well for how do you get information on the service, how do you manage the data that's in there, and so forth. So hopefully that was a really quick recap. As I said, there's lots of additional resources at the end of the deck. You know, there's previous presentations, there's white papers, and if you have questions, come and talk to me. I'm happy to talk about how we do security in the platform or those sorts of things. So what I thought I'd do now is highlight some of the security developments that we've had in the last year, some of the key features, the things that might be really interesting to you. So I talked about Advanced Threat Protection. So Advanced Threat Protection is a capability we have live in the product today. It's been there for about a year or so, I guess. And really what this does is after you've gone through Exchange Online Protection and done your signature-based scanning or some heuristics or that sort of thing, Advanced Threat Protection does two things. The first thing it's going to do is rewrite the URLs that might be in a message. So instead of seeing www.contoso.com, we're going to rewrite that URL so that it's safelinks.microsoft.com/www.contoso.com. And what that means is that anybody who receives that message, when they click on that URL, they're going to come back to our service first. They're not going to go directly to that destination. And we can do real-time reputation check on the URL at that point so that we can make a determination. You know, it was safe when it went out. for the 2 days it's been fine, but at some point the attacker changes it, it goes to a malicious target, now the reputation of that URL is bad, so we can block it. We can stop the user from getting to that URL. And obviously this applies no matter what the email client is because it's written inside the message itself. So, and we also have rich tracking of that as well. So you can go back and you can look and see, well, who clicked on the URL in the 2 days before it actually got blocked. The other thing we have is safe attachments. So safe attachments will, if it hasn't seen an attachment before, if we don't have a virus signature for that file, what it will do is it will take the file out of the email and it will go and put it into a, you know, you'll see detonation chamber or a sandbox environment. It's essentially a series of Azure virtual machines where we run that file to see what happens. Now, that could be things like looking to see if it's going out and making calls to the network or writing to your file system, even something simple like checking to see if it's running inside a virtual machine, because that in itself might be suspicious behavior. So we can make a determination based on that as to whether it might be a malicious content, and then we can block that through the environment as well. I talked about the reporting. This is when this came out, this was really focused on Exchange. So this was a capability we had protecting your email. What you're going to see now is really this spreading across the Office 365 stack. So as we move into SharePoint, as we move into OneDrive for Business or the Office client itself, having these same capabilities to protect the to check against going to bad URLs, to check against bad files, you know, it's going to be shared across the platform. And the integration we have is great too. I think there's a Windows Defender Advanced Threat Protection session, and I think they'll talk about how through the Windows Defender console you can actually navigate, you can watch the suspicious activity being generated, you can see how that links into suspicious email traffic that might have come through, you can look at who's been accessing that email, pivot down into the particular user. So we have some really rich integration across that platform as well. So some of the key updates that we've had just recently to Advanced Threat Protection, dynamic delivery for safe attachments. So as you can imagine, if we're taking that file out of the email, we're dropping it into a virtual machine environment, running it to see what it does, it's going to take a little bit of time while we figure out if this is bad or not. When you've got your email on premises, or you've got like an antivirus solution that's outside of Office 365, we don't really have any choice but to hold that attachment, hold the entire email while we do that check. So it means that it slows down the delivery. You're sitting there waiting for this thing to come through. You know, you're talking on the phone with someone. They say, I've sent it, but you're waiting for a couple of minutes while it does that scanning of the attachment. What we can do with dynamic delivery when you have your mailbox in Exchange online is we can actually deliver the message and hold on to the attachment. So what you're seeing in that screenshot is we put a placeholder attachment in so that we can tell you that, you know, there is an attachment here. We're scanning it, checking out that it's okay. Afterwards, once we've determined that that file is fine, then we can go back and we can update the message. So if you're sitting in front of your computer, you might see this. But if you check your email, you know, 10 minutes later, you'll never see this. You'll just see the attachment because we've gone back, edited the message, put the original attachment back. Nice and easy. So it's a really great usability feature. If we find out that it's bad, we can go and yank the entire message out of the mailbox if you want to. Whatever you want to do with that, we have that control again because it's inside Office 365. We also just introduced the URL detonation capability. So if you have a URL inside a file, so instead of having the attachment to the message, you have a link to the file hosted somewhere inside the message. When you click on that URL now, we can actually go and get the file and put that into the sandbox environment and run that file and see if it's okay before you get the actual file. So again, just giving you that extra layer of capability. Advanced security management. There's a session, I think, tomorrow where Jeff is going to talk about cloud app security. Advanced security management and cloud app security came from the Adalom acquisition that we did a little while ago. So CAS, or cloud app security, is our full-blown cloud application security broker. Advanced security management is kind of the smaller brother. It's the standard sort of thing we do with Office 365. We give you a base set of capabilities, and then enterprise mobility and security extends upon that. So advanced security management is really focused on protecting the Office 365 instance itself. We can do things like generating alerts out of the environment and controlling response to that alert. So if somebody's, you know, signed in and it looks suspicious and they've shared an external file externally, then maybe we want to go and actually disable their account, change their password, force them to sign in because somebody else might have compromised their account. So we can generate those alerts. We can actually go and take that action with advanced security management. We also have some discovery capabilities as part of this. So if you want to know who's using other services inside the organization, dealing with that shadow IT capability, advanced security management can tap into the logs that you have in your proxy server and it can give you reporting information on, you know, yes, there are people using Dropbox, but it's only 3 people in marketing, or Dropbox is a huge problem, we did 10 gigabytes worth of data in the last month to that service, you know, which maybe we don't want to do. So Jeff's going to go through this in more detail and give you a bit more of a comparison. I'll talk about advanced security management specifically tomorrow in my session, but that is there as well. So threat intelligence is something we announced at Ignite in the US just a few months ago. It's in preview now. It's in private preview. We just posted the blog on that a couple of days ago. Probably in the next couple of months, you're going to see this capability come out. And again, I'm going to talk more about this tomorrow. But threat intelligence is really taking all of that information that we're getting from the security graph, so from other Office 365 users, information that we're getting from external cybersecurity experts, even information on what we're seeing, because we can cluster our customers now. So we can actually say, you're a financial services customer, you're a government customer, you're a large customer or a small customer, or a customer in Australia or a customer in Asia, whatever it might be, we can group customers by these different categories. And then we can start feeding this information into you, and we can say, we're seeing significant attacks against Australian customers, which might be relevant to you because you're Australian, or we're seeing significant attacks across the financial services industry. Giving you this proactive information, but also maybe being able to suggest some policies. So you know what, if you turn on this security feature, that's going to mitigate that attack. You know, that might be something that you want to do. Having that surface to you here, give you the drill downs, give you information on what we're seeing. You know, there's this particular attack and they're charging this many bitcoins to recover from it. Or, you know, all of the information that we have in that one place available to you through the Security and Compliance Center. And again, because it's coming from the Intelligent Security Graph, we're picking it up across Windows, from signals we're getting from Windows, from signals we're getting from Azure, from signals we're getting from our consumer platforms, all of that sort of information feeding into Office 365. Secure Score has been out in preview for a while, but we just announced it a couple of days ago as generally available. You can go and play with this today, securescore.office.com. You should see that lighting up through the tenant as well. What this is, it's basically, if you're familiar with the credit score idea, which is probably more of an American idea than anything else, but this idea that you have a score and you can look at what can I do to improve it, or where am I, why am I being lowered when I think I'm perhaps better than that. But this is going to go through and it's going to look at your security position in the tenant. It's going to tell you, you know, you've got these features turned on, and based on that, we're giving you a security score of this. Compared to other Office 365 customers, your score might be low, you can see in this case. So if I want to improve my score, I have a goal of going up 50 points by the end of the week. What does that look like? How am I going to do that? So I've got a slider that I can control. I've got some additional information. It'll tell me, you know, if I go and turn on MFA for all my users, I'm going to get a maximum of 50 points. It's going to protect against account breach or elevation of privileges. And here's some information on how you can do that. If I've got time, I'll come back to it. But it's a great capability. As I said, securescore.office.com. If you're an Office 365 customer, you can go and play with that today. Sensitive content encryption is an interesting one. We've had Office 365 message encryption in the product for quite a number of years now. A lot of customers probably don't even know that it's there. And Office 365 message encryption, you know, as opposed to rights management services, OME was really designed for that scenario where I want to transmit something to someone and have it secured and encrypted in that transmission. But once they've received it and validated their identity, they're then responsible for that information. And so we don't want to keep protecting it. Because you can imagine with rights management, if I protect a file, the protection always stays with that file. So if I'm sending you an account statement that you're going to want to pass on to your accountant, it's no good if I put protection on it and your accountant can't access it because you need to come back to me for permission. So we've taken that Office message encryption. We're building on top of it to make it a little bit easier to use. It was typically called through rules that the administrator would have to set up. Now you're going to be able to say, I want to apply message encryption. It's going to allow anyone to get into a secure portal. They validate their identity. They can reply to you if they want to, and that whole thing is encrypted. Or they can take the information out at that point and maintain it themselves, and they're done. So and if there's additional information on that, that's a really good capability that you have as part of Office 365 today. We added some capabilities to SharePoint Online recently. We have conditional access, and again, you know, you can talk to Jeff in the Enterprise Mobility session about conditional access and where that comes into play. We're pretty good at being able to say we're going to control what device or what you can do if you're coming in on a mobile device. So if you're on an iPhone, if you're on an Android device, you know, we're going to restrict what you can do. Maybe we can prevent you from moving the information around or those sorts of things. The challenge we've had is with browser-based. So when you go and open Safari on that device, or when you're on a PC in an airport kiosk or something like that, how do we control what access you have to the environment then in that scenario? So one of the things we've done is essentially provided this capability in SharePoint Online where we can say, you know, it's much easier now. You can see at the very bottom there to control access to SharePoint Online specifically from IP addresses. So if I want to say nobody can access SharePoint Online unless they're coming from inside our corporate network, it's much easier to do that now through the SharePoint Administration Center than it has been in the past. We can also block legacy authentication. So we can cut out the old Office clients, force people to use modern authentication where we can do things like multi-factor authentication and conditional access checks and that sort of thing. But the really cool thing here is that when you're using Azure Active Directory and Enterprise Mobility, you can set it up so that if people are coming in from an untrusted device, then we can either block their access to SharePoint completely, or we can say, you know what, we'll allow you to have limited access through a web browser, but we're not going to allow you to make any changes or download any files. So I can still get into my environment, I can still open the files, I can read them in Office Online, but I can't make any changes, I can't download something that's going to stay on that untrusted computer in the, you know, the download folder. So it's not interfering with my productivity. I can get the information if I need to, but I've got that protection there as well for the content. So again, that's live. You can go and do that today. We also added some controls for external sharing inside of SharePoint Online. So we've had external sharing in SharePoint Online for quite a long time. If you're not familiar with it, essentially you have this capability where you can share files with people outside the organization, and it was really done for user convenience. We were very specific about the messaging being external sharing, not extranet, because extranet had a whole lot of connotations around security and control and that sort of thing, whereas external sharing was basically me just saying, you know, here, have access to this file, you can have read access or you can have write access. So that was good, but obviously for our enterprise customers, you know, security conscious environments, we needed a little bit more control. So some of the things we have now, obviously, you can control it at the tenant level. You can say no sharing outside the organization. So in high-security environments, that might still be relevant. You can allow sharing. And basically, I should say, this is the top-level control. So this defines what you have access to inside your environment. And then you can go specifically in a site collection to a different level. So if I open it up, in this case, allow anonymous sharing at the gate, you know, I can still go down into the site collections and say there's no sharing in this site collection. In OneDrive for Business, you can't share with people unless they authenticate, which is the policy that we have. So you still have that additional control, but this is really the entry point. So you know, we can control that. We can actually also even say that we can only share with people that are already registered in the organization's tenant. So using the Azure B2B capabilities, you know, administrators would register users from partner organizations inside your tenant. You can control the sharing so that only those users can actually access the system. Still external users, still using their own identity that they maintain, but you have to register them in your tenant, so it's not just users sharing with anybody or somebody compromising an account and sharing files with themselves. Also giving the ability to expire anonymous access links, which you know, was something we didn't have before. If you generated a link, which I often did for things like sharing my presentations, anybody who has this URL can download the file, which is good, but that, you forget about it, right? So that file's going to be there forever. In my case, not a big deal if it's a presentation. Some cases, it might be a problem. So now we can say that they're going to expire after 7 days or 21 days or whatever the case may be. We have some controls for sharing folders as well. One of the things we saw people doing was using external links to share with people inside the organization because they didn't necessarily know, you know, if I'm going to share a file with my colleague, I don't know if my colleague's going to share that file with somebody else. So, you know, external sharing was easy because I didn't have to worry about authorizing everybody that needed access to it. Obviously, that's a security risk because there's no differentiation between somebody who works there and somebody who doesn't. So we added the capability to do an internal guest link. So it's basically the same sort of idea. You have a URL. Anybody who has that URL can access the file, but they have to be a member of the organization as opposed to the anonymous access where anyone can get to the file. And then finally, on the bottom left there, we've added some capabilities around domains. So if you want to allow sharing, you want people to be able to put in the addresses they want, but you know there are some partner companies that you don't want to share with, or on the flip side, you want to be able to say these domain names are okay, but we don't want open sharing, you can now do that. You can blacklist or whitelist domains that people can share with. And you can, you know, list those here as the administrator. The very bottom one is good too. External users must accept the invitation from the same account that it was sent to. You know, external sharing was really about usability. You know, my email address is michael.richards@microsoft.com. That's not what I sign into the system as. So if you send me an invitation to michael.richards@microsoft.com, I can't log in as that account. So that's a bit of a problem. we got around that by saying, well, once you've got the invitation, you can sign in with whatever you want. So I can sign in as mirichar@microsoft.com. So great. Problem with that, though, is that I can also choose to use a live ID or anything else. You know, you're not enforcing any sort of restriction on which account I use. So it got difficult to track, am I actually sharing with a partner, or have I shared with somebody outside the organization, or what's going on? Also can't shut down that live ID necessarily after the person's left. So with this capability, we can say, you know, we're only going to share with particular domains. If I invite you at that domain, you have to accept with that email address. So we really get towards that control of being able to validate the identity of the person who we're sharing the files with. All of this stuff, as I said, live in the tenant today. You can do all this now. So before I talk about this one, it's probably worth just doing a quick recap. When we talk about accounts in Office 365, you can obviously go straight to Office 365 and you can create a user account and have a password in that. Most of our enterprise customers use Azure Active Directory Connect, which is a small piece of software that you put inside your organization, and it takes the information from your domain controller and replicates it up to the cloud. So you've got one ID for the services. As part of Azure AD Connect, you can choose to synchronize the password. So it's not taking the password and putting it up there. It does a one-way encryption so that we have that secure hash in the cloud. So it is a secure process. But some of our regulated customers don't want any passwords to be stored in the cloud. So the other thing you can do is you can do federation, where we don't store any passwords in the cloud. You set up endpoints that we will connect back to when you go to authenticate. So you'll have Active Directory Federation services installed in your environment. You know, when you go to the Office 365 portal to authenticate, it kicks you down to ADFS or a third-party service. You do your authentication back there, and then it sends a claim back to say you're okay, and you get in. Problem with ADFS is, or any federated implementation, is that it's quite complicated to set up. You're going to need certificates. You need a web service. You need redundancy, because if you can't authenticate, you can't get into the environment at all. So that's why we put the password hash synchronization in, but it wasn't quite good enough for some of our larger customers. What we can do now is, with Azure AD pass-through authentication, which is currently in preview, that same Azure AD Connect instance, you can tell it that you want to do the authentication directly on domain controllers. So we can install multiple copies of this inside the organization. It's making an outbound connection to the service. It's not a web service that we have to host and put on the internet. It's an outbound connection that we can come back across to validate the user. So we're still authenticating you against your local Active Directory. We're not storing any passwords in the cloud. We send the authentication down to your Active Directory to authenticate the user and then go back. But it means that it's a very, very easy setup. You know, we can automatically do load balancing across those connections. We can automatically do redundancy across those connections. We don't have to worry about, I have to put a DMZ in and I have to put ADFS proxies in the DMZ, which are going to connect back into my corporate network. It's just an agent running on the servers that connects out, and we can do the authentication that way. So kind of a nice compromise, giving you that single sign-on capability, that authentication for domain-joined computers, the seamless authentication for domain-joined computers outside the environment. Tenant restrictions is another one that just went GA, I believe, last week. So you may have experienced it before. You know, you're in an organization, you want to make sure that people are using your service. You don't want people using free services or other email providers. So you go and block hotmail.com and Gmail and Yahoo Mail and whatever else. But the problem is that Office 365 is a shared service. So I can't block Office 365 for all other customers. So I've cut out the free services, but there are millions of customers on Office 365, or somebody can just go and get an Office 365 trial and they can exfiltrate data that way. What we can do with tenant restrictions now is you have a proxy server in your environment that basically inspects traffic just for the login.microsoftonline.com and a couple of other domains. So just the authentication traffic we're inspecting, not the Office 365 traffic. So don't get the idea that I'm saying SSL inspection on Office 365 traffic is good. Still not bad. Don't do it. Only for the authentication traffic, because it's very minimal. It's not going to slow us down too much. But we inspect that traffic. We put a header in through the proxy to say which domains we actually want to allow. And then when we hit the Azure authentication platform, you know, we can see that you're only allowed to authenticate to particular tenants from this environment, so we can actually reject that altogether. So what this means is that you can say, you know, Company A allows Company B, C, and D, access to Company B, C, and D tenants from inside their network, but you can't get access to Company E, if that makes sense. So quite often requested by some of our larger customers. It's been challenging to do in the past. That's available now. You can do that today. And I guess the nice thing is, because it's an Azure AD feature, it's not actually an Office 365 feature, it's in Azure AD. So this would apply to any software as a service offering that you have through Azure AD or authenticating through Azure AD. Customer controlled encryption or keys or bring your own key. I felt like I needed to include something on this. Basically, I talked about this last time I did a session. We have advanced encryption in Exchange Online and SharePoint Online. So what we've done is, you know, under that idea that we're assuming compromise, we wanted to put a level of abstraction in between the Windows administrator and the service administrator or the service data. So we have BitLocker running on all of our hard drives, so nobody can take a hard drive or a server out of the environment and get access to your data. But if you're a Windows administrator, what's stopping you from grabbing the Exchange database or the SharePoint SQL database or that sort of thing and taking the data out that way? So what we did with advanced encryption was, for SharePoint, it was really simple. We took all the files and we dumped them out into Azure containers. And then each of those containers, each of those individual files, each of the pieces of a file, because SharePoint divides files up into chunks so that we can do differential transfers, each of those pieces had its own individual key. The Azure vaults had keys. We had a tenant key that encrypted everything. So the SQL database basically just became a mapping that said, if you want this file, you need to go and get these seven pieces, and here's the keys that you need for that. And all of that was encrypted. For Exchange Online, we encrypted all the content within a mailbox. So that, you know, again, you can't steal the database. That's all done with a tenant key. We have a capability coming where you would be able to put your own key into the environment, and you can essentially rewrap all of that with your own key. So it's something you can do later on. You don't have to say, I'm holding off on going to Office 365 because I want to run the key, or I want to manage the key. You can do that at any time. We can change keys. We can, you know, whatever you want to do, we have that capability to rewrap. The thing is that I often hear that we need to do bring your own key because it's a security feature. We have a security policy that says we have to manage the key. You know, that's how we manage access to the data. There's a really good session that one of our product managers did from Ignite in the US, and he talks about the cloud encryption myths. So that's why I left that there. You can go and check that out. Essentially, with a software as a service offering, we need to be able to access the data. So bring your own key is not a solution to stop the service accessing the data. It's completely transparent to the user. It's completely transparent to the service because it's happening at a very, very low level when we're actually doing it right. Bring your own key or customer controlled keys is more of a compliance feature. It's a kill switch for the content. It's basically me saying, I'm a global organization and I have users in Europe, but we're going to wind down the European tenant. So I'm going to get the users out. I want to kill the content for those users, make it unreadable, because my tenant's going to stay here, but I don't want anybody to have access to that data. I don't want that floating around, so I'm going to pull the key for Europe. Or I'm leaving Office 365 altogether, and we know that Microsoft keeps our data for 90 days, so we can get it back, you know, but we don't necessarily want anybody being able to access our data in that time, so I'm going to kill the data. I'm going to kill the key, which is going to make the data unreadable inside the environment so that nobody can get access to that. It's meant for orderly exit of the service. It's not a security feature. Happy to talk about it in more detail. There are a whole bunch of risks and complexities to that, which is why we're being so specific on the messaging, which is why Paul Rich talks about it in this session. So I guess key point being, if it's something that you need, then we have that capability. But just understand what it is you're getting the capability for and what you're signing up for in terms of management responsibilities. Data loss prevention we've had in Office 365, Exchange and SharePoint, really since Exchange 2013. So data loss prevention, our implementation is slightly different to the way some of the traditional security vendors do data loss prevention. Our focus is really on user education and on stopping that accidental sharing. So, you know, I'm trying to share some information. I'm sending credit cards by email. Maybe I didn't know that was a policy violation, or I didn't understand the risk. You know, we want to stop that. We want to do it in real time. Let the user know what you're doing is not appropriate. If necessary, we can potentially give you an option to override that. Say, here's my business justification. It's a critical thing. I really need to get this information out. We can do that one-time override, and it'll go to a compliance officer, and you know, we have that tracking of it. But we have, I think it's about 88 sensitive information types built into the system today. So for Australia, that means things like Medicare numbers, tax file numbers, obviously credit card numbers, bank account numbers, those sorts of things. You need to look at other markets, social security numbers, social insurance numbers, whatever it might be. There's about 88 of them, I think, in the environment. You can also build your own, and you can take documents and you can create those as through a document fingerprinting capability. You can create those as templates that it recognizes as sensitive information. So if I've got a new customer account form, I put the blank form in, it generates new customer account or customer account form as a sensitive information type. Then if anybody fills that form out and tries to send it, we can have that detected as a violation. So lots of things we can do in this particular case. You can see the file's being shared outside the organization and it contains social security numbers. So we want to actually stop that. We want to lock it down, make it so that only the owner of the file can access it or the owner of the site and you know, generate an alert and have people go and remediate that. So you'll see the notification to the user. You can see it obviously in the SharePoint interface. We have DLP notifications coming through in the Office client, which I guess is what I talked about last time, the integration we have in Office 2016 for data loss prevention. We also have it as part of Outlook. So when you're creating an email in Outlook, it'll come up and tell you with a nice policy tip that says this is in violation of a policy, this is why you're in violation, we're going to block the send button. You know, you want to fix it before you try to send this email. So DLP is there. You know, as I said, across SharePoint, across OneDrive for Business, across Exchange, the big update we made recently is the fact that we have these unified policies now. So before you had to go and say, I want to create a policy for my email and I want to create a policy for SharePoint. Now we can do it all in one place through the Security and Compliance Center. We can get unified reporting of it. Today, it's basically lowest common denominator, so it's the SharePoint capabilities. So we can say that you can... you use the 88 sensitive information types. What's coming is that ability to use the custom sensitive information types and the document fingerprinting that you can do in Exchange. We'll bring that into SharePoint and OneDrive as well, so you can roll your own templates to say, this is my organization's customer ID number or whatever it is, and have those detected. Okay, how am I doing? Cool. So some compliance highlights. Yeah. So compliance is getting more and more challenging. We have this huge growth in data. And so in trying to meet our requirements to maintain compliance, we might have requirements to preserve this data for a period of time. You know, we want to look at how this data is being used, where it's being used. Do we have to look at deletion policies or those sorts of things? Compliance is really becoming a big challenge. So our vision for managing compliance is really about productivity first. It's the same as that DLP idea. We want to make it so that the user is productive. We want to give the user the ability to control things, to still do their job. We don't want compliance to get in the way. You can't share this file with this person, or you can't save this thing here, or whatever it might be. We want to maintain that compliance, but still allow that productive experience. We also want to do it in place. Oftentimes, especially when we're talking about preservation or records management or those sorts of things, we look at third-party systems going outside the environment and saving a copy over here. And then, you know, how do we integrate the two so that we make sure all changes flow, or, you know, where do we save the authoritative record or those sorts of things. We feel in place is the better approach, and I'll talk about why. And then suite-wide. So we don't want you to have to go to Exchange and create a policy and then go to SharePoint and create a policy. We want to have one policy that applies across everything so that it's nice and easy for you to set and you know that it's consistent as well. So our in-place compliance solutions. Preserving data is obviously vital. You know, whether it's because you've got compliance requirements to keep things for 7 years or whatever that might be. You know, we have, pharmaceutical company has like a 35-year retention policy. There's a genetics company keeping data for 100 years. You know, whatever you need to do to preserve that data, even if it's just, I want to be able to recover files for the next 2 years if somebody deletes something. You know, we need to have that preservation capability in place. You'll need to set that up front, but you'll have that in the background so you can always get the data back. Finding data is very, very important. So we'll talk about e-discovery in a moment and how that plays into it. And then monitoring user activity as well. So the auditing, being able to see the activities people are taking inside the environment, generating alerts off those, and so forth. Data governance is an area we're seeing a lot of growth in. So in the past, we've focused a lot on this idea of preserving data. You know, let's just go and put a legal hold on, and we can keep everything inside that mailbox forever. Anything that changes, we've got it captured. You know, we've made this, almost made a rod for our own back in a way, because we're giving you more and more data, so you can keep more and more storage, so you can keep more and more data. Right, so we have 5 terabytes of storage in OneDrive for Business. Let's just put a hold on that library. Nothing ever gets deleted. It might look to the user like it's deleted, but it's all kept there. So now we have 5 terabytes worth of data just sitting there that we need to process. So data governance is not just how do we store and preserve the information that's in the tenant, or how do we bring in information that we want in the tenant so we can do things like e-discovery and manage it. Old data is the same as we do the current data. but also how do we expire data? How do we go out and purge data from the environment when it's no longer relevant? So all of this sort of bubbles up through the Security and Compliance Center in Office 365. So you can see the Security and Compliance Center there. Again, it's taken all of the individual little bits and pieces that you did in different admin tools, and it's really surfaced them up into one place. So you don't have to be an Exchange administrator and know that I'm going to go into this very particular part of Exchange in order to do preservation. I can now go into the Security and Compliance Center, have the rights I need to do that, but to also to do it across the environment. It's there. It's obviously easier for generalists. It's a lot more powerful for the specific security roles in our enterprises as well. So this is a significant improvement. You can see lots of capabilities around classification and retention and those sorts of things, which we'll talk about. Also going to see proactive suggestions coming from the intelligent security graph as well, feeding in through here. So again, this idea that you might want to turn on this preservation policy or as I talked about the threat intelligence, if we put multi-factor authentication on, it's going to alleviate this problem. So you can go and get to it. It's just through the admin consoles in the Office 365 portal. You'll get to the Security and Compliance Center, and we'll talk about that a little bit. So I wanted to spend some time on in-place preservation or data lifecycle management. A lot of this isn't new, but I thought it was worth touching on. So as I said, we really focus on that idea that we preserve in place. We're not going out to a third-party journaling system. We're not going out to a third-party records management solution. Keep the data inside Office 365. And not only that, bring in data from other systems and put that into Office 365. We have the ability to import that data, and then you can treat it all the same. So we address some of the challenges. As I said, we've given you more and more storage. We used to say that you had 50 gigabytes for your Exchange mailbox and unlimited storage for the archive. SharePoint, as I said, OneDrive for Business, you've got 5 terabytes for the user now. So lots and lots of storage. You have the ability to put this data in. But of course, with that storage comes more data. Having an external system is really doubling your work. It's doubling your traffic. It's also introducing risk, because what happens if we can't create the copy over here in the third-party system? What happens if we create a copy of the original item and it changes over here and we don't reflect that change? So there's a lot of problems with those additional systems. Even things like, I want to upgrade or I want to move to the platform and I've still got this thing sitting off to the side with all my old data in it. How am I going to manage that? We've seen significant problems from customers with that. So by having all of the data inside Office 365, it makes it a lot easier to manage these things. And we've done a lot of work to make sure you're not suffering a financial burden for that as well. So when you put preservation on for a user account, we're going to protect that information. You say you need to keep that for 7 years, but the user leaves the organization. You can take that license, you can give it to the replacement person, and the preservation will actually keep that data there for the 7 years at no cost to you. So we don't charge you for that departed user scenario in Exchange or in OneDrive for Business now. So we sort of addressed that need. We've got the space there available for you. We've got the capability for you to do it without it costing you money. So what does that look like? We used to talk about this idea of like a litigation hold or a legal hold versus an in-place hold. So legal hold or litigation hold was really this idea that we'll just put everything on hold. We'll keep everything in there. So it's just a switch, checkbox, where we put this user on hold. That means that even if we've got a policy in there that says we want something to expire, that information is protected. It's not going to go anywhere. The user might think they've deleted it, but it's gone into a hidden section of their mailbox or a preservation library in SharePoint. So it's there, and we can get to it as the administrators. Versus the in-place hold capability, which was more about flexibility. So instead of saying put everything on hold, we'll just apply a hold for a time period and then allow content to expire, or we'll apply a hold to keywords, in a discovery scenario. I want to preserve things that are relevant to a lawsuit, but I don't want to keep everything else. So we still have that in-place idea, the policy-based approach. But I think now we really talk about preservation policies itself. So I guess where I'm going with that is, rather than saying put somebody on legal hold or litigation hold, we have preservation policies inside the platform where you can go in and you can say, I want to put across Exchange, across SharePoint, across OneDrive for Business, I have a requirement to keep data for 10 years. Turn that on, it will go and protect all your users inside the organization, it'll protect that data. As I said, if they leave the organization, we can keep that data sitting there, it's not going to consume one of your licenses. So that's really your scenario for, I want to recover deleted items for the next 2 years, or I have a regulatory requirement to keep data for 7 years, or whatever it is. The preservation policy is what you should be looking at to do that. As I said, you define it, turn it on, it's there. We also enhanced that recently in order to meet SEC requirements in the US. We've seen scenarios in the past where, let's say an administrator can be coerced into turning off a hold that's been put onto somebody, and that means that all the content that you might have had on hold can expire or be purged from the environment. So in order to make sure that doesn't happen, as part of the preservation policies, we included a preservation lock capability. So if you go in and you define a preservation policy and you say, I want to keep everything in my organization for 7 years, and you put a preservation lock on, you can't turn that policy off now. All your data is going to stay there for 7 years. You can't even call Microsoft support and say, I put this policy on, I need to turn it off. Preservation lock is locked. Like, this is your immutable archive. This is your guarantee that that data is going to be preserved, that meets all your legal requirements. So it's a significant change that we've introduced. You do want to use it with caution if you're going to put the lock on, obviously. But it means that you can have confidence in Office 365. You can have confidence that when we preserve the data, it's going to stay there. We don't have to maintain a separate system that people don't have access to because somebody could compromise the administrator. We have that protection in place so that we can store the data in the service. So really, I guess that's the key part I wanted to make. There's a bit of confusion sometimes with regard to the term archiving. So I often talk to customers and they say they need to do archiving. In this environment where we're preserving it in place, we preserve the content inside the Exchange mailbox. So if you delete something, it moves into a hidden section of the Exchange mailbox. It's preserved there. The user thinks it's gone. So we're still giving them that flexibility to clean up their mail, but we're keeping it in a protected area of the mailbox so that we can discover it. Same sort of thing with SharePoint or OneDrive for Business. The user thinks they've deleted it. It goes into a preservation library. It's protected. What we've done recently is we've actually flipped the capability. I said before that Exchange, you had a 50 gig mailbox and 100 gig archive, and you could actually expand that because we had the marketing concept of unlimited storage. You now are seeing us rolling out 100 gigabyte mailboxes in Exchange Online and then 50 gigabyte as the archive. So the archive is really an optional capability that you can utilize purely for storage management. You don't have to turn on an archive. Preservation is about protecting your data. Archive is about managing storage. I guess that's probably the key point I wanted to get across as well. If you want to turn on an archive, we're rolling out auto-expanding archiving capabilities. It's coming. It's not there yet. But we will have a capability where you have that 50 gig archive. As you start to approach that space, we just generate another one and another one and another one and another one. So you've got unlimited storage. And when you turn on an archive, by default, anything older than 2 years in your primary mailbox is going to move over into that archive anyway. So you can do that if you want to, but again, you've got a 100 gigabyte mailbox now or soon as part of Office 365. You don't necessarily need to do an archive. You can do all that preservation with that mailbox. And then we've increased the recoverable items quota as well, so when you delete things, they're not counting out of your mailbox storage, but we can still preserve them. So. A lot of stuff I just threw at you there. I'm happy to go through it again afterwards if you we're going to have time for questions. Those are the things I wanted to make, the key points I wanted to make. We preserve data in the service. We believe this is a much better way of doing it than the old school like journaling or record solutions or those sorts of things. We've given you capabilities to do that and still maintain compliance and usability and those sorts of things. If we look at the compliance data lifecycle, we're going to come back to the e-discovery section in a minute and the auditing section in a minute. I just wanted to point out the left-hand side. So you can see there that we can bring in your data. We have the ability to bring in either through a drive shipping capability. You generate some files, save them onto hard disks, and you send the hard disks off to our data centers. We plug them in, we move the content in for you. Or you can do an upload over the network. But this allows you to bring in the data that you might have on premises in third-party archives, in file shares, whatever it might be. Bring that data into Office 365, keep it, preserve it. You don't have to worry about paying for that separate system or maintaining the storage for that system. You put it all in Office 365 and let us worry about it. But then you also get the benefits of preserving it and searching across it and that sort of thing. We also, through partners, have the ability to bring in a whole lot of third-party content. So, you can see some examples there, Twitter. I can potentially bring in all the tweets that somebody does, all the posts they do to LinkedIn, include that as part of their mailbox data. So when I'm doing a discovery across a person, I'm not just getting what they've done through their work email account or their Skype for Business account or in their SharePoint and OneDrive files. I can see that history across what they're doing on social media as well. So we have those capabilities. What I didn't mention, Skype for Business Online, will actually archive directly into the Exchange mailbox as well, if you weren't aware of that one. So that means that we can actually preserve conversations that people are having through Skype for Business as well. We have that instant messaging history. This is different to the conversation history folder that you might see in Outlook. That's a convenience feature. This is server-side archiving for compliance purposes. So we have all of that covered. Again, it's a very rich, robust solution that is meeting the needs of our enterprises today. So I talked about the idea of preservation and how preservation was really the focus in the past. We've done a lot of work in the product as well to implement deletion policies. And those are live today. You can go in and you can do some deletion policies and you can say, I want to target content that's older than 10 years and just delete it. I think it was very easy in the past to say, let's just go and put a hold on and keep all that content and that way it's there if we need it. But now we're starting to see risk in maintaining all that data. So, you go into a lawsuit, you go into discovery with the court, they say, how much email data do you have? Well, I have 20 years. Okay, well, now the scope of discovery is 20 years worth of email content. So you're going to have to go back through 20 years worth of email content to find something that might be relevant. There are certain benefits in being able to say, look, I only have 5 years worth of email. It's less data for me to process. The more data I have to process, the more it's going to cost me in time, in outside legal counsel review fees, whatever that might be. So obviously you need to maintain your compliance position. So that's why having the intelligence feeding in, these are the requirements of these regulatory policies or that sort of thing. You want to have a 7 year. You're in financial services, you might need 7 years. You're in genetics or medical research, you might need 50 years. Whatever it is, you're having that information feeding in so that you know what sort of policy to turn on can be useful. But having that ability to actually expire the content, allow it to go away or even force it to go away after a period of time helps us manage some of the risk of that data being there. So, as I said, we have deletion policies in Office 365. You can go and do that today. What we've announced with advanced data governance, and I'll talk about more tomorrow, is the idea that we can utilize some of the machine learning, the intelligence that we've got in the platform, the suggestions that we have through what other customers are doing, all of those sorts of things to help you with this challenge. So to help you, as I'm picking my data up and importing it, do I really want to import all of my data? Or am I just going to import data for a period of time? Okay, that's a pretty simple example. I'm importing 5 years worth of data. That's an easy thing to filter on. But maybe I actually want to look at the data that's coming through and say, I just want to import data that's of a particular type. I don't really care about conversations that people might be having, but if they're sending credit cards or if they're sending customer account forms or something like that, that's probably data that I want to import and put into my system and preserve. Anything else can get turfed. So being able to utilize those sensitive information types that we use for DLP to say, based on this file having credit cards, it meets this compliance policy, I need to retain that. These are some of the things we're going to be able to do with advanced data governance. And as I said, getting rid of all that old data, purging the trivial sort of stuff from the environment. So I'll talk more about that tomorrow and show you, because again, this is another one that is in private preview today. You'll probably see this released in the next few months. So Office 365 eDiscovery. We've had, again, eDiscovery capabilities in the product since really the 2013 stage, or in a usable form. We've had the ability to do searches across the product for quite some time. I guess the point I want to make here is really just that eDiscovery is not just about going to court or dealing with your regulator. We can use these same tools for our internal investigations. So, through eDiscovery, I can actually do a search against sensitive information types. I could use the eDiscovery engine to say, show me where people have saved credit card information inside OneDrive for Business. Obviously, through the data loss prevention capabilities, if somebody saves a file in, I can start picking that up in real time or in the... I can go back and pick it up. But with eDiscovery, I can say, go and do a search across the environment. Tell me if this is even an issue. Now I'm concerned about driver's licenses or Medicare numbers or something like that. Go and tell me if that's an issue. Do I need to put a data loss prevention policy in place? I can do that through eDiscovery. But eDiscovery itself is really this idea that, first of all, we preserve content so that nothing can happen to it while we're figuring out what to do with it. And as we step through the process, we reduce the data set. So once we identify who's actually relevant, we can drop off some of the preservation. We don't have to keep that data around anymore. As we search through those particular users, we can find the content that's actually relevant instead of all the stuff that they have that's not relevant to this case. You can then go through and analyze the data. We have tools in there that help you do the refinement to analyze the data so we can get down to a shorter and shorter set so that you're not reviewing hundreds of thousands of pages of results. And then finally, producing that content so that you can send it out for review by outside counsel, or you can give it to a judge or give it to a regulator or whatever that might be. We have all of that capability inside Office 365. We have connections inside Office 365, so you can choose to dump this out directly into, you know, a mailbox or a file share or something. You can dump out an Excel file that's just going to give you information on what's in it. We have the ability to dump out files in a format that can then be taken straight into a third-party system. So if you've got outside counsel, they probably use their own particular tools for they're very specific legal tools for doing document review and markup and that sort of thing for trial. So we can produce the content in a very easy way for them to take it and import that and do their thing. Actually, I didn't have a link in here. There's a really good white paper that we just released on eDiscovery as well. It talks about how Microsoft is saving, I think it was like $4.5 million a year on eDiscovery through the capabilities we have in Office 365. And there's been some presentations at past conferences too that talk about how we do it and the benefits we've got. It's really this part, the analyze, because especially, you know, somebody's time to review content, whether it's an in-house person, whether it's an outside lawyer, it takes a lot of time to review content manually. So anything we can do to reduce this set down to just the really relevant stuff is going to be, you know, really beneficial. And that's one of the things that you can see with advanced eDiscovery. Again, in the product today, I'm going to talk about it a little bit more tomorrow, but where eDiscovery is focused around keywords. So I'm looking for this word, it might be near that word, you know, those sorts of things, just quite strict queries that I put in place to try and find data. Advanced eDiscovery is able to do predictive coding and machine learning, so I can train the system to understand what is relevant data and look at patterns and generate content that it thinks is going to be relevant. So you can see it giving some reporting information here. If I go through and review, I don't know, 25 documents, I'm going to get 80% of the relevant content out of my environment. As I review more and more content, which takes time, which costs money, I'm getting less, it's diminishing returns. So it sort of helps me view how much content do I want to go through. I can sit down with opposing counsel. We can look at, you know, what makes sense to go through here. But a lot of tools to help you go through this much faster than you would and find things that you simply wouldn't with keyword searches alone. I'll talk about that more tomorrow. We introduced an audit logging pipeline in Office 365 some time ago. You need to go into the tenant and turn this on. But once you turn this on, we capture events for everything that a human does in Office 365. So anytime somebody changes a file, adds somebody to a group, shares a file, whatever it might be, we capture that in the audit pipeline. So typically, we see this surfacing through the activity report in the Security and Compliance Center. You can go into the environment, you can see the audit log, you can search, you can say, tell me what this person's been doing or whatever it is. Or we see it surfacing through the Management Activity API. Because we have a lot of customers who already have logging tools, you know, security incident event monitoring tools. Whatever it is you want to use, you want to maintain that process. Through this activity API, we have connections into third-party tools so they can bring the data in. Is there an issue? Okay. Okay. Yeah, so we can do that through the data. The other thing I wanted to point out is we have this alert policy capability. So you can actually go into the environment now and you can define some alerts and have it send you an email. So if I see somebody making a change, send me an email. If I see somebody sharing something outside the organization, send me an email alert. Now, how is that different to advanced security management? ASM can go a little bit further and say, if I see this happen, then go and do this action, like block the user. This is purely like a search that's being delivered to you by email. So if you don't have ASM, you have this as part of Office 365. What data is audited? As I said, everything a human does in Office 365 is audited. Now, this is not just your users, but our users as well. So if Microsoft did access your data because we're fixing a support problem that you might have, you'd see a Microsoft user, you know, performing actions in here as well. Customer lockbox. So customer lockbox, essentially, you know, we've talked about this before. When we need to get access to data, we don't have any standing permissions. Everything in the service is automated. You know, we're running at such a scale that we don't have people logging onto servers and making changes. We simply can't. Everything's done through a service fabric. So typically, the only time we would ever need to touch customer data is really when you call us with a support incident and say, we've got some sort of problem. You know, I need you to help me recover my mailbox or fix the SharePoint corruption or something like that. So it's really in response to customer requests anyway. But you make a request, it goes through the support process to the engineer. The engineer determines that they need access to data. And So they'll go through a lockbox request. They'll go through a process to make a request into the system to get access for a period of time. They say why they're using it. It's doing some background checks to make sure that that user is actually entitled to make that request. If it goes through, it goes to a manager. The manager reviews it, does their own checks. Do we really need to access customer data? And if the manager says, yes, it's okay, then the engineer gets access. They can run those very, very specific PowerShell commands. They can only do it for a couple of minutes or half an hour or whatever time period they actually specified. And then all of this gets reviewed on a monthly basis because we don't want this happening. We don't want people manually touching the service. We don't want people touching your data. We don't want people, you know, running PowerShell commands outside the service fabric. We review this on a monthly basis to say why was that necessary? What can we do to change the service so we don't need to do that in the future? But all of this happens, you know, in the background to you. It's just part of what happens while we're working on a service request. For our regulated customers, you want additional control over that. You want to be able to say, you know, maybe no, I don't want that to happen right now because we're in a change freeze or whatever it is. So customer lockbox is giving you the ability to insert yourself into that loop. So after the manager determines that it's okay, we generate an alert. To your administrators, tell them to go to the portal. They'll see in customer lockbox requests some details about the reference number, what the ticket number is, why they need access, and you can either approve or reject that. So if you don't respond within 12 hours, it automatically cancels. We don't get access. If you say no, obviously we don't get access. So again, this is for regulated customers to be able to say we have the final say in who accesses our data. There's no way Microsoft can access our data without us knowing about it. Okay. Yeah, so I guess it's helpful to understand how often this happens. One recent month that I saw figures for, and think about the scale we're operating at. We had millions and millions of customers in Office 365. In a given month, we had, I don't know, like 9 requests through Lockbox or customer Lockbox, 9 out of millions and millions of users. 5 of those were actually Microsoft IT. So 4 actual customers required us to touch their data in the space of a month out of the millions and millions of customers that we service in the platform. So it's there if you need it. It's, you know, we can do that without violating our service level agreements and that sort of thing. It's a capability you have if you're in that regulated industry, but it's obviously not something that everybody needs. Okay, so I think overnight at the RSA conference, we announced our new Microsoft Trust Center. A couple of things a few days ago as well. But basically, we've redone the Trust Center, and it's really about being able to target information to specific roles. So we had the Trust Center in the past. You could go there, and it gave you information on how we run the service and white papers and all this sort of stuff. But it was kind of difficult to figure out where do I find what I'm looking for. So now it's been redone, so I can come straight in here and say, you know what, I'm a business decision maker, so let's look at Microsoft's cloud services and give me information about that. Or I'm a risk and compliance officer. I want to run a risk assessment against Office 365. What resources do I need in order to figure out how I do a risk assessment? So it's going to give me that targeted content, the suggested white papers that are going to be relevant, suggested audit reports that are going to be relevant, and it's going to link everything back out through the Service Trust Preview. Now, we have, whether it's the Service Trust Preview, whether it's the Service Assurance Dashboard inside the Security and Compliance Center in Office 365, we have this environment where we make all of the information available to you. You used to have to contact us and say, hey, look, I want to see your ISO audit report or I want to see your SOC report. You can get all of that now yourself and have been for some time. So you can go into the portal. You can get the third-party reports and read what the auditor has said about our service. There's lots and lots of white papers in there. How do we do encryption in the service? How do we do data resiliency in the service? How do we protect you against denial of service attacks? How do we do isolation so that you can't access another customer's data? All of that sort of stuff is sitting there inside the portal. What I guess one of the nice things this has done is oftentimes we're working with larger organizations, we say, oh, it's just go and get this report. It's in the Service Trust portal, and they don't have access to it. So you have to go to internal IT and figure out who can give me access to the portal. We've made it sort of front and center. Without it needing a credit card, you can just go in, sign up for a trial, and get access to all those audit reports. So as I said, anything you want to know, there's a risk assessment tool in here that was produced by Ernst & Young. You can come in here and grab that file, and it can help you with the risk assessment, mapping across the frameworks. All of those white papers, all of the reports, as I said, everything is there for you, and you can go and do that today. I'm going to come back to that because I have less than 10 minutes. So where would you go to get information? The best source I can tell you is still Office blogs. We have mechanisms inside the tenant, the message center, service health dashboard, those sorts of things. But in terms of what's happening with Office 365, what's changing, the best advice I can give you is go to the blog, sign up for you can filter it down and say, I'm just interested in Office 365 or whatever it is, as opposed to general Office, or I'm interested in security or I'm interested in development, whatever it is, you can filter that down, generate an RSS feed that you can put into your mailbox that shows up as unread emails. This is the best way to get information because we'll often post it here on the blog first or post that we're working on this capability. Best way to get information on what's happening. It's still, oftentimes, we see the information come out on the blog before we get the internal notification. So that's really the best place to get information on the service. We also have the public-facing roadmap, which we've just recently revamped, I think over the weekend. So you can come in here, you can see the roadmap. Again, used to be something that you had to do in a private conversation with Microsoft. You now have all this information available to you publicly. You can go in and look at what's launched, what's rolling out, what did we cancel, what have we previously released. So you can see there's quite a lot of capabilities we've added into Office 365 because I took this screenshot yesterday. And then if you want additional details, you can obviously go back to your account team and we can see what we can do in terms of providing additional information. As I said, the sessions will be up on Channel 9. The Microsoft Virtual Academy has some really good stuff in there as well, actually. A number of good courses in there that you might want to look at. And then there's the plug for the Spark After Dark thing, which I think is Thursday night, so please do your evaluations. And I'm going to stick around. I've got 5 minutes left, so I can do some questions. I'll stick around maybe outside after the session. But yeah, if you have questions, come find me, send me an email. I've got another session tomorrow afternoon on advanced security features. I hope that was useful.